Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is July 1st, 2021, and I'm your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is You Can't Always Get What You Want. The TTM2 trial. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Justin Morgenstern. He is an emergency physician and the creator of the excellent FOMED project called First 10EM. Well, Justin, I'd like to say happy Canada Day, but it's not the happiest of Canada Days this year, is it?
Ken, I'm really proud to be a Canadian. I think there's a lot to celebrate in this country of ours. But yeah, we probably need to pause for a moment and acknowledge that there were people here for a very, very, very long time before we came along and started calling this place Canada. And like almost every other country in the world, unfortunately, Canada has an absolutely horrific history when it comes to our Indigenous people. So I know some people will definitely not be celebrating Canada Day this year.
And some people will be celebrating Canada Day. And I think, you know, there is a lot to be proud of what we've done as Canadians. But boy, we're not done. And there's a lot of work still ahead of us. And I think we need to acknowledge it, recognize it, and work towards it. So if you're going to celebrate, fine. If you're not going to celebrate, which I'm not going to celebrate this year because I had to work, I think it's important that we start focusing in on addressing some of these long-term systemic problems, which I am not an expert on, and that's not why we're here today. But I thought it was important at least to acknowledge it since we are recording it on Canada Day.
100%, absolutely agree.
And, you know, surprise, surprise to our neurology listeners, this is not an episode on TPA and stroke. We actually do cover a wide range of topics on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
You know, it's actually what makes emergency medicine so damn interesting, but also so hard. Our specialty touches on like literally every part of medicine, and so we have to be absolute experts in everything. I sort of imagine that a weekly EBM podcast might get a little boring in other specialties, but with the SGEM, there is an absolute endless range of topics that we could cover.
Yeah, and there are a vast number of topics that we do cover, but we just seem to get the most feedback when we cover a paper on lytics. I wonder why that is.
I still haven't figured out why some people get so much more worked up about some topics than others, Ken. You know, the things that we've said about the stroke literature when we get together are really not that unique at all. The EBM community in general has pointed out weaknesses in literature across the board in medicine. We advocate for the need for replication studies across the board. We talk about uncertainty across the board. And actually, today's example may be a perfect example. There were a couple small RCTs that completely changed medicine, but the EBM crowd was always a little skeptical, and we pointed out the flaws and the remaining uncertainty. The big difference here for therapeutic hypothermia is we actually got some large follow-up RCTs.
Exactly. And so today we're actually going to do a structured critical appraisal on the TTM2 trial. And you wrote this great First 10EM blog on this publication. So I reached out to you and said, hey, Justin, you want to do some more knowledge translation with me and turn it into an SGEM episode? And actually, that's where I got the theme music idea, The Rolling Stones, which was featured in the 1983 movie, The Big Chill.
Yeah, Ken, you can't always get what you want. Every emergency doctor wanted therapeutic hyperthermia to work. It was easy for us to do. And after pouring our blood and sweat into these resuscitations, we really want to give our patients the best possible chance. We would have been very happy with a positive trial. Can't always get what you want. But we got what we needed, an answer to a very important question, even if that answer was it didn't work.
So give us a case to set up the podcast.
So a 58-year-old man collapsed in front of his family, and no, Ken, we did not immediately activate code stroke. When the paramedics arrived, they found him to be in cardiac arrest with V-fib on the monitor. Paramedics managed to get a return of spontaneous circulation after a single defibrillation, but the patient is still comatose on arrival to the emergency department. The charge nurse turns to you and asks, should I go grab those ice packs?
Therapeutic hypothermia has been the mainstay of post-cardiac arrest after publications of two trials back almost 20 years ago now. It was 2002. that both suggested a benefit. There was a trial by Bernard and colleagues that randomized 77 patients, so relatively small trial, with an initial cardiac rhythm of ventricular fibrillation who had achieved return of spontaneous circulation, or ROSC, but were persistently comatose. The trial was not truly randomized, as groups were based on the day of the month, and it was also not a blinded trial.
The results of this Australian trial seemed too good to be true. Therapeutic hypothermia, and I'll say, Ken, whenever I say therapeutic here, I say quote-unquote therapeutic, because that sort of implies it works. But quote-unquote therapeutic hypothermia resulted in a large improvement in neurologic outcomes, defined as being well enough to be sent home or to a rehab facility. It was 49% in the hypothermia group as compared to only 26% in the normothermia group. That gives an NNT of 4. Absolutely unheard of. The p-value reported was borderline at 0.046. And actually, when I plug this into a calculator, it comes out as 0.06, so not statistically significant.
The other trial was the hypothermia after cardiac arrest, or HACA. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, HACA. But it was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, 2002. They randomized 273 comatose adult patients, so it was a bigger trial, but this was out of more than 3,500 screened patients. These were witnessed out-of-hospital cardiac arrests who had a shockable rhythm, achieved ROSC, and had a short downtime. Now, this trial used an air mattress to cool patients and was also not blinded.
Yeah, this second trial done in Europe also showed very impressive results for favorable neurologic outcome. It was 55% with hypothermia as compared to 39%. That's an NNT of 6 this time. And they also reported a 14% absolute decrease in mortality with quote-unquote therapeutic hypothermia post-out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah, those, you know, when you see numbers needed to treat in the single digits, it can seem like it's too good to be true. But as a result of these two smallish trials, hypothermia was widely adopted. However, there were many voices in the evidence-based medicine world that reminded us of the significant uncertainty that remained and the weaknesses of these two trials. The SGEM actually covered a few trials looking at doing hypothermia for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest in the pre-hospital setting. And the bottom line from those three podcasts was, there's not good evidence that therapeutic hypothermia is superior to usual care and cannot be recommended. So I guess we would just call it hypothermia and not therapeutic hypothermia.
Now, in this case, because of the remaining uncertainty, a much larger multi-center trial was run. So this is the original Targeted Temperature Management, TTM trial by Nielsen in New England Journal of Medicine 2013. And I think everybody knows about this trial. They compared two different hypothermia groups, 33 degrees and 36 degrees. And there was no difference in their primary outcome of mortality at the end of the trial. And there was no difference in the other important outcomes, cerebral performance category, modified Rankin score, or mortality at 180 days.
And we did a structured critical appraisal of the TTM trial on SGEM number 82, and the bottom line was that the trial did not demonstrate a benefit of a targeted temperature of 33 degrees versus 36 degrees for survival of out-of-hospital cardiac arrests.
But both groups in the TTM trial were hypothermic, so although it's the highest quality evidence available, it didn't tell us whether hypothermia was better than normothermia, which is why the TTM-2 trial was performed.
So what was the clinical question they were trying to answer with the TTM-2 trial?
So does hypothermia result in improved survival after cardiac arrest as compared to controlled normothermia?
And the reference?
So this is Dankiewicz, I think, et al. For the TTM-2 trial investigators, hypothermia versus normothermia after out-of-hospital cardiac arrest in the New England Journal of Medicine 2021.
All right, let's run through the PICO. What population did they include in the TTM-2 trial?
So they looked at the patients you would expect, comatose adult patients admitted to the hospital with ROSC after an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, irrespective of the initial rhythm.
And what was the intervention?
So this is hypothermia with a target temperature of 33 degrees Celsius, maintained there for 28 hours and then slowly rewarmed.
And what did they compare it to?
They compared it to normothermia with an aim to maintain a target temperature of 37.5 degrees Celsius or less at all times.
All right, let's run through their outcomes. What was their primary outcome of interest?
They looked at all-cause mortality at 6 months.
And how about their secondary outcomes?
Their main functional outcome was poor functional outcome at 6 months, defined as a score of 4 to 6 on that modified Rankin scale.
So the authors concluded, quote, in patients with coma after out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, targeted hypothermia did not lead to a lower incidence of death by 6 months than targeted normothermia, end of quote. All right, let's go through the quality checklist for randomized clinical trials. And I'm going to say off the bat, this was a well-done trial. But we're going to go through the yes-no things. So the first question is, did the study population include or focus on those in the emergency department?
Yes, it did. And then, of course, continue on into the ICU.
And did they adequately randomize these patients?
Yes.
Did they conceal the randomization?
Yes.
Did they do an intention to treat analysis because it was looking for a superiority? So that's an ITT analysis as opposed to a non-inferiority trial, which does a per protocol analysis.
Yes, they did.
And the study patients, did they do consecutive recruitment?
Yeah, we're on a roll. Yes, again.
And were the patients in both groups similar with regards to prognostic factors?
Yes, they were.
See what I mean? This was a well-done trial, well-organized, well-done trial. How about the blinding, though? All patients, were they unaware of group allocation?
So no, this was an unblinded study, although there were physicians performing standardized neuroprognostication exams, and they were blinded.
And all groups were treated equally except for the intervention?
We'll have to give this one an unclear, especially because it's unblinded, and I don't think we have enough details.
How about the follow-up? Was it complete?
Yes.
And do you think they considered all patient-important outcomes?
Yes, I do.
And the last question, the 11th question, was the treatment effect large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
So no, the results were precise enough, but spoiler alert, there was no difference, so it can't be large enough.
All right, let's run through the results then. They assessed over 4,300 patients for eligibility in the trial and randomized 1,900 of them. The mean age was 64 years with 80% male. Most, and what I mean by most, 91% were bystander witnessed arrests. Bystander CPR was performed in an impressive number of patients, 80% of the time of these arrests. And 3/4 had a shockable rhythm. I will put the consort flowchart in the show notes that wasn't available in the publication, but was available in the supplemental material. How about the key result, though?
So as we already said, there was no statistical difference between the hypothermia and normothermia groups.
Yeah, and remind everybody what that primary outcome was and what were the numbers.
Yeah, so the primary outcome was all-cause mortality, and it was 50% in the hypothermia group and 48% in the normothermia group. It wasn't statistically significant.
And for their secondary outcome, this was at 6 months as well, 55% of both groups had poor functional outcomes defined as a modified Rankin scale score of 4 to 6. And again, we'll put in the relative risk and the 95% confidence interval in the show notes.
And in any study, it's really important to think about harms. In this study, arrhythmias resulting in hemodynamic compromise were more common in the hypothermia group, 24%, as compared to 16%, a statistically significant result.
All right, Justin, let's dig in and talk nerdy. You ready to go?
Yeah, let's do it.
I love talking nerdy. Okay, number one is about blinding, and we brought this up. Keeping everyone perfectly blinded in a study like this would be very difficult to do, so it makes sense that it was an open-label study. However, the lack of blinding certainly increases the risk of bias, especially for more subjective outcomes like neurologic function. Now, we're unsure which direction the bias would have been. Did the clinicians and researchers think that hypothermia was going to have a benefit or not? It would have been interesting to survey the individuals who were conducting this study and doing the evaluations before the trial to see what their thoughts were of this treatment a priori.
Nerdy point number two is about the primary outcome of death. Death may not be as objective an outcome as we sometimes think. Now, when a study is unblinded, you really want to see an objective outcome being used. And death is generally as objective as it gets. Either you're alive or dead. And I know you want to throw in a quote there from one of your favorite movies.
Look who knows so much, huh? Well, it just so happens that your friend here is only mostly dead. There's a big difference between mostly dead and all dead.
But in general, you're alive or dead, and there generally isn't much debate. However, in a modern ICU, we actually have a lot of control over when somebody dies. If the doctors truly believed in hypothermia, they might decide to keep somebody alive longer to give them a better chance, and that could bias the results. Now, these trials did try to account for that by ensuring that independent, blinded physicians performed a standardized assessment for neuroprognostication in all patients. And so although I think it is worth discussing, I really don't think this plays a huge role in biasing the results we see here.
And you brought up harms in the results section. And although I anticipate many people will focus on the harms from the arrhythmias, which were greater in the one group, I don't think it was ultimately that important. Arrhythmias resulting in hemodynamic compromise certainly sound important, I mean, but ultimately, that's a a monitor-oriented outcome. And the reason we care about arrhythmias is that the patient might die or have poor neurologic outcomes. And those are much more poos or patient-oriented outcomes. In this trial, the poos were not different. So ultimately, I don't think it's truly a harmful practice, but rather a neutral practice.
Nerdy point number four, in my opinion, is maybe the most important. It's about control groups. Did these authors choose the best possible control groups? Now, both groups in the trial had their temperature controlled to some extent. It was controlled normothermia, but was that necessary? Although there's a very common hypothesis out there that avoiding fever is incredibly important in this patient population, there are actually no RCTs that demonstrate a benefit from fever control. And this study still leaves us with the question of whether any temperature control is necessary. I would have loved to see a third group with no temperature control at all, because that would have helped us settle this issue once and for all.
I agree with you, and I can understand why you like the fourth nerdy point about control group. But I have to say my favorite was number five, because it's my favorite number. But also, it highlights the importance of skepticism. This story arc around therapeutic hypothermia for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest is a great reminder of why we should be skeptical of any claim. The time to accept a claim is when there is sufficient evidence for the claim. And there are many examples in medicine that show we can be susceptible or fall prey to intervention bias. We want to do something. And we can be overly optimistic about small studies that are nowhere close to being scientifically definitive and quickly crown borderline practices as silver bullets or the standard of care.
Yeah, dare I say it? Think thrombolytics for stroke? Or maybe we can tick some other people off. Think TXA for just about anything, perhaps. Or think cardiac stress testing. Science is a process that requires replication. Single studies rarely, if ever, are going to define the truth. The overzealous adoption of medical practice can hurt our patients. You know, time and time again, we adopt medical interventions that are unproven. And in many cases, the harms end up outweighing the benefits. But we only find that out or acknowledge that decades later when these replication studies are finally done.
If they're finally done. And then, ooh, we act all shocked about medical reversal that EBM experts were predicting all along. I mean, we spend tremendous amounts of money, time, and energy completely overhauling parts of the medical system to address a specific disease, ignoring the tremendous scientific uncertainty that remains. We balk at the time and effort required to complete confirmatory RCTs, and people say, oh, well, we don't need a replication study. We are one and done. But that completely ignores the much larger expenditure we make adopting a new practice and then having to de-adopt that practice when and if a replication study is done demonstrating there isn't superiority.
Yeah, and I also think that this overzealous adoption of medical practice also hurts evidence-based medicine as a whole. EBM experts out there who point out this uncertainty are often labeled as nihilists. It's sort of a joke, but every Cochrane review concludes more studies are needed, and so people end up downplaying the importance of science in medicine. They argue that, you know, we would never do anything if we just waited on the science, but the problem is more studies are needed, and especially in medicine, because we have adopted a pretty laughably low bar of a p-value of 0.05.
And another important point, Justin, is that in emergency medicine, we're good at handling clinical uncertainty. It doesn't paralyze us. It doesn't prevent us from taking action. It doesn't mean we can't act. We do act. We just acknowledge that our actions are provisional. And we know that bad mistakes occur when we act overly confident. For some reason, we are much less comfortable accepting the same uncertainty when it exists in science.
Yeah, uncertainty isn't nihilism, it's just uncertainty. It's exactly what it says. From the day the original hypothermia papers were published, the EBM community highlighted the remaining uncertainty. I think I heard about this on EMA with both of our mentors, Dr. Jerome Hoffman. It was clear that more trials were needed, and many anticipated that those trials would end up being negative. However, acknowledging that uncertainty is not, again, the same as proclaiming ineffectiveness.
Yeah, and in the face of uncertainty, and there is a lot of uncertainty in medicine, a lot of what we do is based on very weak evidence. We need to judge the potential benefits, the potential harms, and the degree of uncertainty to determine our provisional actions. And frequently, that means adopting a therapy while waiting for future trials. The problem is not using a treatment with imperfect evidence. The problem is ignoring the fact that the evidence is imperfect and declaring an intervention the standard of care. That is a mistake we have made time and time again in medicine.
And once things have been declared standard of care, we often get stuck. In this case, unfortunately, I think this trial will not change a lot of people's minds. Despite the clearly, and I'll say quote-unquote negative, but this was a pretty negative trial. So despite these negative results, there's an accompanying editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine that concludes, and I'll quote, "Targeted temperature management is a crucial treatment strategy to improve outcomes in patients who have had a cardiac arrest." Considering the evidence we have available, I really don't understand that conclusion.
Yeah, and I don't understand the conclusion either. I mean, certainly there is uncertainty, right? Certainly there is uncertainty. Targeted temperature management could or may have a role, but the best available evidence runs counter to that hypothesis. And remember, the burden of proof is on those claiming efficacy for therapeutic hypothermia. The best evidence we have is there does not appear to be anything therapeutic about therapeutic hypothermia. Well, that's enough nerdiness. Let's comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusion.
So we agree that in patients with coma after out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, targeted hypothermia did not lead to a lower incidence of death by 6 months than targeted normothermia.
Can you give an SGEM bottom line?
Yeah, the combination of the TTM and the TTM-2 trials make it pretty clear that hypothermia does not result in better outcomes for post-arrest patients. It remains to be seen whether there's any benefit from targeted normothermia.
And can you resolve the case that you presented?
So based on these new findings, you spend your time searching for an underlying cause of this patient's cardiac arrest and optimizing the many aspects of high-quality supportive care that are required, but you don't worry too much about the patient's temperature.
And so now that we have the TTM-2 trial, how are you going to take this and apply this information clinically in your practice?
Well, as always, this is going to be a team decision. I've got to involve my critical care colleagues up in the ICU. But for now, there does not seem to be any value in inducing hypothermia in the emergency department for our comatose post-arrest patients.
And I know that your patient is comatose, so this whole idea of what do you tell the patient. However, you're going to be talking to the family members of this comatose patient. So what are you going to say to them?
Yeah, I think this is actually so important. It's always surprising the things that get into the collective consciousness. So if I was talking to the family, I might address it directly and say, hey, you might have heard of something called hypothermia, where in the past we tried to cool patients down after they had a cardiac arrest. However, the latest evidence suggests that hypothermia is not helpful. So we can focus our attention on other really important aspects of your loved one's care.
All right, it's time to announce the Keener contest winner. And last week's winner was Bill Stoltzfus. And he knew that Chlamydia trachomatis was first discovered in the conjunctiva of an orangutan. What's the question this week, Justin?
I mean, that's a great question. I certainly did not know that. So the question for this week is, in the movie The Big Chill, all the actors come together for the funeral of Alex. Interestingly, all of the scenes containing Alex were cut, so the character never actually appeared in the movie. So the question is, what actor played Alex?
All right, if you know this Big Chill question for this episode on the TTM2 trial, then send an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize.
This is a topic with a great deal more FOMED that has already been published, and I'm sure we'll see more. I do have one up on my website, First10EM, and I've seen it on the bottom line on Canadium and on MCRIT so far, and I'm sure there'll be a great deal more commenting on this big landmark trial.
And you can get CME credits for listening to this SGEM podcast. Every episode now comes with CME credits. And so if you want to get credit for something that you're already doing, I mean, the content, it's always free. It's part of the free Open Access to Medical Education initiative. But if you have to collect some credit hours, hey, what better way than getting it for something that you're already doing, listening to the SGEM? And I'll put a link in the show notes that you can click on.
Sounds especially good in a year without any conferences. Everybody needs those CME credits.
Well, thank you again, Justin, for doing another SGEM episode with me. And I want to say, because this is July 1st, good luck to all the new residents who are starting today. You've got this.
Yeah, this is my absolute favorite time of year. I get to spend all day tomorrow in orientation doing simulation with some new residents. It's overwhelming those first couple days, but it's going to be a great couple years of your life.
Welcome to the family, everyone. All right, Justin, can you read the SGEM tagline?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.